This is an interview with Henry D. Patterson and Claire Zeger Patterson, conducted on May 12, 2011, at the Patterson Residence in Denville, New Jersey. The interviewer is Robert Zeger. He's Claire Patterson's brother. Also attending and listening in is Gay Zeger. Well, thank you very much for doing this interview. This is an important project for our oral history program and the Library of Congress program. And we're interested in your experiences during World War II, but also interested in something about your family, your upbringing, your education. Claire, where did you grow up, and what was life like for a teenager in the 1930s in the Great Depression?
During the 1930s, I was 10, about 12 years old. There was a family of four children at that time, and my father worked very hard. Fortunately, he had a job. He worked very, very hard, and we did quite a bit of moving. When the rent was due, we'd move to some other place, and I lived in three or four different towns before I went into middle school.
This was in
Northern New Jersey, Dumont, Tenafly, Englewood, and none of us ever thought of ourselves as being poor, because I think everyone else around us also was, although others maybe had a little bit more.
And you went to the public schools of the towns that you lived in?
Yes, I went to the public schools, and the biggest recollection is the ones in Englewood, where I went to grammar school for several years and then to junior high, and then on to high school, Dwight Morrow High School in Englewood. And
Henry, how about you? Something about your family. Who were your folks, and where did you live?
I was born in Jersey City, and by 1 year old, I had moved to Ridgefield, New Jersey, in a house that was built on my grandmother's property. I went to school in Ridgefield, public school, to eighth grade. Went from there to Englewood Junior High School, where I first saw my wife, and then on to high school.
What did your father do?
My father was very fortunate, very hard worker. He was worked for Pennsylvania Railroad, and at the time I was very young. He was a fireman, shoveling coal on the trains. And then he gradually moved up to where he had a very supervisory job.
I see. Mm-hmm. And did you also go to Englewood High School?
I went to Dwight Morrow High School in Englewood, right.
I tell people that you once played football against the Vince Lombardi team. Is that what
That's not correct.
Not correct,
That's
I'm
not
sorry.
Not correct. I knew Vince Lombardi, and I was chosen as a senior, I don't remember, to play on a faculty student basketball team, and there weren't enough men faculty that could play basketball, so Vince Lombardi came over from St. Cecilia High School.
That's where he was a coach at St. Cecilia's.
Yeah, and then he went from there to West Point, and I think from West Point to Green Bay, but I don't know.
Right, okay. Let me ask you both now, Claire, first, about how aware you were of things. We look back at the 1930s and see how dangerous things were and war clouds were threatening and so on. You were both born in 1923, I think that's right. And so you were 16 at the time that World War II began in Europe in September of 1939. How aware were you and your family members and schoolmates, teachers for that matter, of such world events as the rise of Hitler, Japanese aggression in China, the attack on the Soviet Union, the outbreak of the war, and so on? Are these things part of your memories as a kid?
As I look back on that, I'm really quite amazed to think that I don't recall it being discussed in school. I don't recall our teachers reacting to it, but that could be my memories. I don't recall that we just kind of went on life as usual at that point.
How about your parents? Were this some you'd hear your father
ranting
and raving or anything like that?
I don't remember any of that, but my father wasn't at home too much. Yeah. He was always there supper time. But then he'd go out to work again, and I never remember discussions about it. But that could be me.
Well, that's part of the experience.
Yeah.
Henry, how about you? Were this something that you were you following these things? Your parents involved at all?
No, but what I can remember, there wasn't a lot of discussion in my family about the world events at the time, and. The teachers in school, I had PAD, Problems in American Democracy, never touched on any of that stuff. It was all previous history.
I see.
And what I can remember is we used to go to the movies once in a while. You could get into a movie for a nickel or for 10 cents, and there was always a short news program, Pathé News.
Yeah,
and I would see Hitler's and his group goose-nepping. I would see different indications of history. And I would go home and I would be dreaming about that, and I would be scared. But that's all that I can remember.
Yeah, the newsreels. Do you remember, Claire, do you remember Pearl Harbor, where you were or how you heard the news or what it meant to you?
Pearl Harbor, I remember it, of course. I can't believe that wasn't a tremendous impact on me, except that I thought that now we're going to be at war. And it wasn't until it kind of set in that I thought of all the implications of it and the tragic loss of lives and but I don't remember dwelling upon it. Yeah.
Henry, how about you? Has that come like a thunderbolt? Do you remember where you were?
Pearl Harbor so vividly. I was not the brightest student in high school, mostly because I didn't work and I didn't particularly like what I was taking. And the things that I liked were taken away from me because they felt his grades are going down, take the things and he'll move up, which didn't happen. I went from high school on a work scholarship to Cheshire Academy.
Cheshire Academy?
Connecticut.
In Connecticut.
In Connecticut. And I did well with my studies here. And we were in the lunchroom and we heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And we heard President Roosevelt declare war on the Japanese people. And that had a big impact on all of us. And maybe because we were at school and away from home, or maybe it was something that was within us, I don't know.
Was it clear to you at the time when you heard about the attack on Pearl Harbor, did you, in a way, say, well, I'm 18. I'm gonna be part of this. This is gonna affect me directly. Or wasn't that?
Yes,
something?
That did come into not only my thought, but all of
it. You were very aware of that.
Boys' school, and we were all very much aware of it. And to go along with that, I have spoken at high schools about my wartime experience, and that was one of the big things that high school boys were interested in is how this affected you and how will it affect me if I were going to.
Yeah. Of course, at that time, there was a draft in effect, the military draft.
That's right.
Whereas, of course, there isn't today.
There isn't now.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
I would like to turn to your World War II service now. Talk first to Henry about his service overseas and in the U.S. Navy, and then turn later to Claire's experiences on the home front. So my first question is, when and under what circumstances did you enter into military service? Were you drafted? Did you volunteer? And why did you choose the Navy?
That's a very interesting question. I chose the Navy because I love the ocean. I chose the Navy, I think, because my grandfather was in the Navy. I chose the Navy because I did not want to go in the Army. I enlisted in the Navy. It would have been early January in 1943.
43.
Yeah. And I did not pass the physical exam because they found the albumin in my urine. So I went back to live at home and made several trips to Cleveland where I had enlisted. And finally, the situation passed and I was accepted into the Navy. And it was at the time that the Navy started drafting people. So your question is interesting to me because I had done all the paperwork, and whether I was a volunteer or a draftee is a question.
I see.
A question mark.
Yeah.
But I think because all of the paperwork had been filled except that one item, I think that the answer would be volunteer because I did.
Sure. Certainly in your mind, you were a volunteer, regardless of...
And that's not putting people who were drafted down. That's not putting them down at all.
I understand. So where did you do your basic training and your stateside training?
That's... Two is a question.
Okay.
I went from Cleveland by troop train to the Great Lakes, which was the largest naval training station in the United States, and it still is.
That's near Chicago, is it not?
That's right outside of Chicago. It's northwest of Chicago, between Kenosha and Chicago. Training is... It's a big question mark. You were there for about 6 weeks, between 4 and 6 weeks, depending on how they needed it, the people. The training amounted to marching, and that's all. You were there mostly to get your inoculations and your shots so that when you went overseas, you could go. I had two experiences that I will not forget from basic training, and I don't know whether this is a question
Tell
that
us
goes
about them.
After or not. But the first night I arrived at Great Lakes, we were all in the barracks, and an officer came in, and he assigned us all to different jobs. And when he called my name, he said, "You have the 12 to 4 watch. That means you go on watch at 12 o'clock at night and you relieve at 4 in the morning." And he said, the first thing you're going to do is you stand by this urinal and you watch the urinal.
Urinal?
Urinal. That's what I said, urinal.
Yeah, okay.
And he said, "If I come in here while you're on watch and I find you sitting down or I find you asleep, you're going to be in big trouble." Well, this gave the daylights out of all of us. So that was my first experience in the Navy.
There wasn't any attack on the urinal or anything like
no,
that?
No, no.
Okay,
no.
Well, that was good.
And people think that your uniforms are free. They're not. You pay for your uniforms. The first issue is free, and after that, everything else you pay for, as it wears out, you buy the new ones. But we were at Great Lakes for just a very short time, and we were told to put our bathing suits on. So you put your bathing suit on. And then we walked to a building, and we started to climb upstairs, climb upstairs, climb upstairs. And I said, what the devil is going on here? And we got up, and it was a platform. And you walked out to the end of the platform, and the swimming pool looked like a postage stamp. And all of a sudden, the guy behind you gave you a shove, and off you went. And it seemed like forever before you hit the pool. And after a while, they told us, this is in case you have to go off an aircraft carrier. You know what it feels like to go from the flight deck to the water. And that was a scary time for all of us. I was asked if I wanted to go to into the engineering crew, or I wanted to be a deckhand. And my choice would have been to bend in the submarines, and I was too big. So I chose going below decks. And when you go below decks, one of the first things they do is send you to firefighting school. You go and they set a building on fire, they spread oil around, and it's burning like crazy and black smoke, and they give you a fog nozzle and a hose. And I didn't know first thing about any of this stuff. And they tell you, walk and come out on the other side. And you walk through this burning inferno, and all of a sudden, all of a sudden the flames all disappear from vision, and you walk right through it, and you don't get burned, but you come out black as can be from all the smoke.
This was at Great Lakes too, or is this separate place?
Yeah.
Okay. So what about after Great Lakes? Where did you get sent then?
After Great Lakes, I was sent by troop train from Great Lakes to Portland, Maine. I was assigned to the USS Texas, which was a pre-World War I battleship. And most of the crew on that were all recruits like me. That's where they sent you to get some training. I walked on that ship. I didn't know enough to salute the officer at the deck or to salute the quarterdeck. I walked on the ship, and the first thing I was told was, don't you know how to come aboard a ship? And I learned from then on, this is what you do. You ask permission to come on the ship.
Yeah.
They sent me down to the engine room, and I met Commander Bond.
Bond.
Bond, B-O-N-D. Uh-huh. And Commander Bond, I shouldn't say it, because I don't know. But I don't think he knew any more about engineering than I did. And he said to me, do you want to go in the engine room or the fire room? Well, I don't know. I didn't know the difference. So he said, well, tell me, can you handle tools? Well, I said, yes, I can handle tools. Engine room. So that's where I wound up. That's how I wound up with a pretty responsible job. I started out that way.
Uh-huh.
And I had no schooling, I had no training, I had nothing. And I made one trip across the Atlantic Ocean.
On the Texas.
On the Texas. One trip each way, round trip. And we had convoy duty. And that's the most amazing thing that you could ever see. Between 50 and 100 ships all together, radio silence, no sounds, no lights at night, and how these ships would travel and zigzag across the ocean and have very few accidents was signaling by the Attis lamp. You know what an Attis lamp is? It's a light that you see flash. They use that in the daytime. They use Morse code with flags, and they use semaphore codes.
So ADDIS would be ADDIS?
That's correct.
I'm saying this for the transcribing.
I realize it. And you would go along, and all of a sudden, the admiral would give the word to blow the whistle. And all of the ships would turn exactly at the same time, to the same direction, following the orders that they had received by the signal. And every once in a while, you would read in the paper where somebody made the wrong turn, and they would have a problem. But that worked so well. And I went across to Gibraltar. I came back and then was transferred to the USS Quincy.
This first voyage on the Texas would have been sometime around the summer, fall of 43 or?
Yeah. That,
doesn't have to be exact. Yeah, I'm just trying to get a fix.
No, it would be before fall.
So summer of 43?
Summer probably. Or spring. Or late spring maybe.
That's just when the submarines were at their most dangerous.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So then you got transferred to the USS Quincy.
And the USS Quincy, it was like going from a Model T Ford to a Cadillac. The Quincy was was being built in Quincy, Massachusetts at the Bethlehem Steel Yard. And because I was assigned there before it was built, I became an automatic plank owner. And a plank owner, P-L-A-N-K, like a
plank.
Wooden plank, yeah. And that indicates that you were on the ship before it was commissioned. And you get things ready. And I was stationed at Bethlehem Steel Barracks in Braintree while they finished up the ship. And they would send us on the ship, and we'd work with the civilian yard birds and learn how to take care of things. We'd work with the guys who were in the Navy for a long time, who were in the engine room, who knew the ropes and would show you how to do things. And from there, we went on a shakedown cruise. We went to Guantanamo Bay, went down to Puerto Rico, and came back and just in time to go over for Normandy.
So this would have been obviously in the spring then of 44.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were part of the D-Day invasion fleet.
Oh yes, I wish. I went over and we went to Ireland and we went to Scotland, and that's where the right off Glasgow and Greenock, Scotland.
Greenock.
Greenock. Greenock, I think.
Can be looked up. You had, speaking of Greenock, you told me earlier a story about someone you later got in touch with through ham radio.
Yeah. I don't know whether this is the point. We pulled into Greenock, and there were hundreds of ships in there, all waiting to go to D-Day. And We had a leak in the condenser, and the condenser is made out of special metals, and I can't remember. One is bronze, and what the other ones, I don't remember. But the welders on a ship could have fixed that, but for some reason, they wanted the somebody from the Greenock Navy Yard to come out and do it. So the welder came out, and I'm sure we talked back and forth and were eye to eye together. And about 60 years later, I was on my amateur radio station, and I was talking to a man in Greenock. Then he said, "Have you ever been to my country?" And I said, "Yes, I was there when we were getting ready to go to Normandy. And we had a steam leak on the ship, and we needed a welder. And I didn't say any more. And he said to me, when he came back, he said, "You were on the USS Quincy, and I was the welder who came."
Amazing.
And repaired the ship.
Amazing.
Amazing. This is between 50 and 60 yes. years after.
Yeah, yeah. And after. He came up with the ship's name.
Yeah, yeah. I've been my engine.
Fantastic. But, that's really something.
But from there, and I have two very, very historic birthdays. From there, we went down to off Sherbrooke. And there were tons of ships. There were barrage balloons all over.
This is off the coast of France, off the coast of Britain.
Yeah, right? No, I don't know whether this is the time to talk about this or not. But this caused a change in some terminology on our ship. We often hear a friendly fire that knocks something down or kills a bunch of Americans.
Yeah.
And many of us were up on the deck, and we looked up, and way up in the sky there was a dogfight going on. And we didn't know what was going on, and one airplane was hit. And it was hit by one of the ships, not ours, but one of them. And someone misunderstood the command. It said Spitfire, and they thought they said open fire. And from then on our ship, never was the word Spitfire used to give an order that I know.
Because the Spitfire was a British plane that
That's right.
the other ship inadvertently shot down.
Yeah. But a lot of people don't know that D-Day was to be on June 4th, which is my birthday. And because the waters were so rough, the landing crafts couldn't get into the beach. So they told the landing crafts, as many as they could, to tie up along the big ships. And we had a number of LSTs and LCIs alongside. And these guys were cold in June. They were cold. They were soaking wet. They were sick. And first thing we heard somebody say, "You guys got any coffee?" And the Navy, you always have coffee. You can go all get coffee anytime you want. So we ran and we got coffee. And we put the cups in a bucket and we lowered it down and so that they had some coffee to drink. And a little while later, somebody would holler, "You got any sandwiches?" We didn't have anything like that. So a bunch of us went around and we went to the cooks and they gave us some bread and they gave us cold cuts and things, and that one in the buckets went down. And then one of the things they called up, "Do you have any ice cream?" we got ice cream. So we sent that down. And my afterthoughts on all of that was you may have given some guy the last ice cream that he ever had.
Mm.
And I felt pretty good about that. Even though some of the stuff that I bite my tongue when I say it, some of the stuff we had to steal to give to the soldiers. And I often wonder, why didn't they ask those poor guys to come up on the ship and spend the night on the ship, because we were there for a little while. On June 6th, we went in, and the landing craft went. And you get up and you look out and you see body parts and you see wreckage. No fun to see.
Floating in the water.
Yeah. No fun to see.
Now, your ship participated also by bombarding the...
Yeah, that was our main function.
What was that like being in the engine room when one of these big... Quincy was a cruiser, which
That's
is
right.
the second largest of the ship. It's slightly
heavy
smaller.
Cruiser,
but, yeah.
The heavy cruiser has 8-inch guns, and around the engine room, boiler room, it has 8-inch armor plate. It has what you people would call a ceiling that was about 4 inches thick. When you went down into the engine room or the boiler room, that hatch was closed. You knew when you went there that if anything happened, you were not going to get out because the but runs on high pressure, superheated steam, and you'd be fried instantly. You, I don't know how to compare it. But when a shell hits alongside of your ship, the whole thing moves. The explosion in the water pushes that whole ship aside. When they used shells that would explode close by, you'd hear the shrapnel hit all over, and you would not know what was going on. The chaplain's main function and his battle station was on the bridge, and he was on the microphone, and he would tell you everything that was going on through his eyes.
The men in the engine room.
To the men below decks,
yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Where they couldn't see.
Did how was it when the ship would fire off a salvo?
Yeah.
That must have been pretty obvious. In other words, the ship would roll?
Yeah, it would just move sideways. It wouldn't roll much. It would
I
move
see.
Sideways.
But you'd know.
But when they were coming at you,
yeah.
Then you would get a roll or you would get a lift
yeah.
up
yeah.
or you would get something.
Yeah, wow. Were you under a lot of fire with the German batteries?
The German forces were excellent marksmanship. Excellent marksmanship. Far better than the Japanese, because the Japanese had was a different point in the war for them.
Yeah.
But the Japanese was the kamikazes, where here was sure to land and back and forth. But they were very good.
Did the Quincy get hit?
We got hit once. We got hit once. And the best part of the ship was where it was hit. And that's where they canned the stored the candy and the ice cream and the cigarettes.
So it was a good thing you guys gave some of that ice cream to the troops. It wouldn't have been any good anyhow.
Yeah. But it's funny how a job changes. Maybe that's not the right word. But when I went on the Quincy, on the Texas, my watch was in the engine room, and I was a messenger. And you would, instead of the telephone, you would go to say, we need this, and you went and got it. Or at nighttime, when it came to get rid of the garbage and the oily rags, they'd send you up on the deck, and it's pitch black, and you don't know where the heck you are. And you hope that the deckhand fastened the life railing around, otherwise you could walk right off the ship. But If I had gone to battle stations here, I was in the moving the ammunition from the magazine to the gun turret. On the Quincy, when I first went on it, I was on the 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns. And I hated that up there. Boy, I would have given anything to get out. My regular watch was down in the engine room, and I was a throttleman. A throttleman controls the speed, controls how fast the propeller's turning, helps the captain to make turns. And you also have to know the mechanism of all the other people who are on watch. So you have to be pretty much on the stick. And one day the chief engineer called me in and he said, "Who do you know?" I said, "What do you mean, who do I know?" He said, "Well, Captain Sam has asked to have you go on throttle." And I said, "Why me? He doesn't know me." He said, "He knows when you're on the throttle because it goes down in a log." And he said, "He feels that you are so accurate and so quick to get to follow his orders that this is who he wants." So then I was transferred down, and my battle station was his throttle.
I don't know about Navy ranks.
I was a second class machinist mate when I came out. Uh-huh. I went in, I was a third class fireman. You can't get any lower than that. And through experience and through written tests and through oral tests by the engineering officer, you are recommended to move up a rank at a time. Machinist mate second class would be equivalent, not to the top sergeant, but a sergeant rank in the Army, which people are more familiar with.
Yeah, technical sergeant or a
In that area.
Yeah.
The symbol on the patch indicates where you belong on that ship. My patch had a propeller on it, meaning that I was in the M Division, main propulsion.
I see.
Yeah. Okay, if you were an electrician, you'd have a lightning rod, or a radio man, you'd have a different thing.
Yeah, yeah. I understand. So after D-Day, what?
After D-Day, we traveled up and down the coast of France until we ran out of ammunition. And then we went over to Weymouth, England.
I've been there.
And they gave us enough ammunition to go back. We went from there, and I can't really remember. I think we went from there to Oran.
In Algeria, in the Mediterranean.
Yeah, to do some more firing practice. And then we went down to southern France between Toulon and Marseille to help with the landings down there. We had very little return fire down there. It was mostly coverage for the Army. And I found out just a few years ago, When I was given the award from the French government, not that I was a hero, but just that I was in the right place at the right time, the 117th Cavalry, but it has a mobile cavalry now, was going across to land at Normandy for the Battle of the Bulge to go in on that. And for some reason, it's the only time that they know of that the army split a division. Half of it went to northern France, half of it went to southern France. And we supported the 117th, and I think that was in the Jersey division. I'm not sure.
In both places.
In both places.
So you were part of both the D-Day landing and the Southern France landing. That's several weeks after.
I can't remember what the code name for that was.
I was trying to remember myself. I thought I knew, and I it disappeared.
It'll come to me in time.
Yeah, well, me too, probably. go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I had a pretty good birthday that year.
Yeah, that was memorable. Yeah. 21 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, very good.
20 years old.
I thought you were born in 23.
Yeah.
Well, this was 44.
My birthday wasn't that the after.
June 4th, 1944, you would have been 21.
43, 44, I don't know.
Oh, I just meant that D-Day was June 6, 1944.
Yeah.
So you would have just passed your 21st birthday. Just as an aside here, I understand that in the preparation for the D-Day landing, you met General Eisenhower.
That's right. Met him. I shouldn't say I met him.
You encountered him.
He spoke to me. and he inspected all of the Navy ships. He came on, and everybody had to be in their dress blues, and he walked by me, and I knew I had a peacoat that was different than everybody else's. But it was warm, and I didn't give a darn. And he came, and he looked at me, and he said, "Sailor, that's not an official peacoat." How the heck does he know what's an official peacoat? But he spoke to me, and he said, "You make sure you get another one by the next time I see you." And he never would see me again.
So after the French landings, the Quincy went.
We came back to Boston, and we didn't know what they were doing, because all of a sudden our ship was transformed. They put ramps all over. They put a crazy thing over the side, the outside of the ship. And we had not the vaguest idea of what was going on. We left Boston and headed to Norfolk. And we were able to have Christmas leave in New York City. And I was lucky I could come home, because I lived right across the river. And Claire would come down, and we would visit with one another.
Because by then you were engaged to Claire, girlfriend,
we're just going,
friends.
Just going together. And then from New York, we went to Norfolk, and they did a lot of changing, stuff all over them. And then we headed to Newport News, and we're sitting at an old derelict dock, and all of a sudden the ship was sealed. That means nobody off, nobody on, no telephone calls, no letters, no anything. And pretty soon a train came alongside, and an armored car came off it. And the crane on the back of our ship picked up the car, put it on the hangar deck, and we looked out, and there was a whole group of people. And little did we realize that it was President Roosevelt, and we were going to leave and take him to Yalta, where he met with Churchill and Stalin and a bunch of other.
Did you meet Roosevelt personally, or just see him from a distance?
From the distance. You know that here he's on the United States Navy ship, and security was just as strict then as it is now.
Yeah.
First day at sea, they would call us up by divisions, and we'd watch the Secret Service guys shoot at tin cans that were hanging at the edge of the crane on the rough ocean. And you'd see those cans go down, or you'd see them explode. And you get the message, stay away.
So you took FDR across the Atlantic. There was still some submarine danger.
A lot, yeah. We went across with destroyer escort. After his meetings, we came back without destroyer escort.
Could I ask you first, you say this was for the Yalta conference, but you didn't sail all the way through the Black Sea to Crimea, to Yalta itself, or did you?
No, we took him to the island of Malta. I think I have that
right. I think you're right about that.
We took him to the island of Malta, and we left him there. And he flew from there to Yalta.
Yeah.
And we after some target practice, we went down through the Suez Canal to Ismailia. And we anchored at the Red Sea, I think.
Yeah.
The Red Sea. And we anchored there and waited for him to come back to our ship. For some reason, he flew to meet Stalin because Stalin refused to come down to meet him and Churchill. Why, I don't know.
Yeah, that's part of the... So you picked him back up then at the end of the Yalta conference? I mean, after...
After part of that conference. I think they called even where we were.
I see.
A part of it, you also do,
yeah.
But I don't really know that. But Haile Selassie came, Ibn Saeed from
Saudi Arabia. Yeah.
King Farouk
from Egypt.
And I don't know how many other big leaders were there, and you could see them. The common pictures that you see. I was. When I go on deck, it'd be 100 feet from here.
Yeah, and this was all on the Quincy.
This was all on the Quincy, a very interesting thing happened, and I don't think you'll ever see this in a history book anyplace. The USS Murphy was sent to Saudi Arabia. It was sent there to pick up Ibn Saeed, to bring him to the Quincy for his meeting. They put carpets on the deck. They had goats and sheep running around on the deck. They had tents for his entourage on the deck. And as I'm told from friends that I met on the Murphy, they pulled out of Saudi Arabia, and the people made such a fuss because their ruler had never left the country. And they thought the United States was kidnapping their leader. He had to go back and quiet this down, and then they came up by the Murphy to the Quincy. The Murphy made a big turn, a wide swing, and either the captain of that ship or the helmsman made a very serious mistake, and they broadsided us. And I can imagine the embarrassment these people on the Murphy had.
Murphy would have been a destroyer?
Destroyer. When front of the President of the United States and all these dignitaries, you have this. And really no serious damage was done, but it hit us hard enough that the two planes fell off the catapults. And they had to send divers down to check both ships.
Wow. A lot of people date the beginnings of our whole Middle Eastern policy to those meetings. And the Quincy's often mentioned in the accounts about it,
But, you know, when Churchill would come to visit Roosevelt.
On the Quincy?
On the Quincy, The first time I ever saw Churchill, I don't know who he was, but I knew the hat and cigar.
Yeah.
So they had built ramps for Roosevelt, and Churchill's walking up the ramp, and he's smoking a cigar, and his daughter Aunt Sarah was with him, and I guess a lackey, I don't know what you call those people, but he walked up and he got to the end of the ramp where he was going to go on the ship, and he took a cigar and he handed it to the guy because he wasn't supposed to smoke on the ship.
So then you brought Roosevelt back?
I brought Roosevelt back, And that, according to Mike Gannon, and he's an authority on submarines, he said when we came through the Straits of Gibraltar with President Roosevelt, there was a wolf pack waiting for us. And no one knows how fast a Navy ship can go. I was on the throttle, and all the time I was here, it was never open all the way up, so that they knew exactly how fast. But boy, I got the information on the engine room telegraph. We were flying through that water. We outraced the destroyers. And
really?
We came back with that, Now, I think, and I shouldn't say it, but the Quincy at one time had the record from France to Boston.
Just speed record.
So
you're back in, you dropped Roosevelt off.
Yeah.
At some point, we're at Newport News again.
Yeah.
And then you go back up to Boston.
And then they took everything apart. And then down through the Panama Canal.
So after you get refitted in Boston, your war is not over.
No, we went from there. We were thinking we'd get leave. We didn't get leave. We went right through the canal.
Panama Canal.
Went to Hawaii, and that's I looked trying to find your brother.
Because my brother Richard was stationed in Hawaii.
I couldn't find him. And then we went from there to Okinawa and supported the landings in Okinawa.
Were you bombarding the Japanese positions in Okinawa?
Yeah.
Did the Quincy come under a kamikaze attack?
Yes, it did. We didn't shoot many of them down, but we shot one down.
Really?
And the rule on a ship is when general quarters sounds and everybody runs to their battle station, you go forward and down on the starboard side, and you go aft and up on the port side. And the first time that General Quartus sounded, when the kamikazes were coming at us, you never saw so much chaos on a ship. Nobody remembered which way to go or how to go. And boy, we pretty damn well learned in a hurry.
Yeah. So that must have been a harrowing experience as well, being under that kind of attack.
Yeah, it's scary.
Which
I say offhand that it's a scary thing, but you know, in all of the action that I was in, and all of the things that I saw, I never was scared. In those conditions, I would be scared before. If it was over, I'd be scared. But there were about six or seven guys in the engine room with me. And they were all my friends. And I thought, something happens to me, somebody's going to take care of me, and I will take care of them. And I never got scared. I never was scared. See, the captain of my ship, boy, if I ever admired anybody, top notch.
What was his name?
His name was Elliot Senn.
Senn?
Senn, S-E-N-N. His father was an admiral, Senn. And after he was transferred to Quincy, he became an admiral. He came from Sitka, Alaska. Hmm. He could move that ship. We'd pull into New York to go, and the tugs would be waiting us. And he said, get them damn tugs out of here. If I can't get this thing into a dock without a tug, I don't belong as captain. Boy, he could twist. And he would see those shells coming and I had to get out of the way.
There was time.
Right?
There was time. You could maneuver.
Yeah.
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 So what? And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but it sounds to me like you're saying that that the Navy's training and getting you ready for combat and so on, they did a pretty good job of all of this.
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Here. But I mean, you speak my colleague here says that one of the questions I had was about, you know, daily life on the ship and so on. And I'm instructed to ask you about when the ship was not in action, about cleaning the bilge and where the propeller is.
Anybody that's skinny that goes in the engineering department of a ship got to be crazy. Because all the openings are small, and the skinny guy has to go through them. You have to crawl through the double bottoms to check, to make sure there's no leakage once in a while. You have to crawl into the fuel oil tanks to see that they're clean. You get all of the crummy jobs. You go into the condenser, and you go in and you find dead fish, you find so many things, and once in a while an arm or a leg or something else that has to be taken care of. Thank goodness for the medics. You go in and you find them and you holler, get the medic, and he comes down and fishes that stuff out. But it's no good place for a skinny guy.
We should mention that Mr. Patterson is at age 87, still about 6 feet four, and retains his youthful figure.
Which is, no, not quite.
I just have a question here about, and actually you probably answered it, but you may have things to add about the wartime experiences that stand out. There are a lot of memorable experiences. Are there things that we should add to your account of your wartime service?
I think that dropping those things off to the...
That's quite a story. I
think that's...
It's a very powerful story.
I think the other thing that stands out is... When a ship goes beyond 45-degree angle, you don't expect it to come back. The year after my birthday at Normandy, we were heading out of Okinawa and the typhoon hit. And our sister ship in Pittsburgh washed about 75 to 100 feet about, broke right off. The water was that rough. And they didn't lose a person because of the watertight integrity. we went to between 30 and 38 degrees. And everybody thought, well, we're going to just flip right over. And that ship miraculously righted itself and came back. And what it did, it sucked in the hawsers into the circulating pump, into the impeller of the circulating pump. And that was a job to get that rope out of that thing so the pump could
These work. Are the big mooring ropes.
Yeah.
And it
yeah.
just...
It sucked it right in.
Yeah, wow. It got all tangled up in the...
In the impeller.
Yeah.
And what that impeller does, it pumps water into the condenser, and the steam runs through the tubes, and it condenses it so that that water is reused again to make more steam.
So that was probably as frightening an experience as being under fire.
That was worse.
Than being under fire, even.
Yeah, that was worse.
Where were you? Remember VJ Day?
Oh, yeah. I remember before VJ. I remember the Enola Gray going over the top because we were headed into Japan to bombard. And all of a sudden we were turned around. And it was either the next day or later that day that we heard that the bomb had been dropped.
Did you understand, appreciate the meaning of that? Atomic bomb? I mean, you knew that Japan had been under attack.
You know, that depends on where you were. If I were in the United States, I probably would have thought, boy, all these people killed, all this damage done, everything in shambles over there. And when that bomb dropped, all of us on that ship thought, oh boy, now we can go home. So it depends where you are and what you're looking at.
Well, I got to say, I was 7 years old, and I can remember banging on a pot and pan and saying, thank God Henry and Richard and John can come home. So I don't know if it was completely different, but I know what you mean. Thank God for the atomic bomb.
Thank goodness Harry Truman had the guts to say, do it.
So you were on the way to bombard the Japanese home islands.
Which and then after that was dropped, we went up and down and bombarded all over.
Still, even after the dropping of the bomb, because they hadn't surrendered.
And then we pulled down. The plans had already been made, but we pulled down and pulled into Sagamiwam, which is
Sagamiwam.
It's a bay. Right at Tokyo, and we pulled in and we anchored right behind the Missouri.
Which was the ship on which the surrender was accepted.
Yeah, and I had a first class shot of watching all the things going on in the Missouri. We weren't that far away. But it was a very interesting thing to see.
Yeah, so you were there.
And I thought, boy, they signed a treaty, I'm going home tomorrow.
But that wasn't the case.
It wasn't the case because all of a sudden, during the war, people were released by the length of time that they put in service, the number of battles they had been in, and a couple other things. And I found out that a second-class seaman can be in charge of a whole engine room when you come back to the United States. Not because you're so smart, but because there's nobody else. They've discharged everybody else.
Everybody more senior.
Yeah.
Was there any thought, just to go back just a little bit, that you might actually see ground fighting if you had invaded Japan?
No. But what we did, because I was in the engineering department and knew steam engines, they drafted people from our ship to go into the Navy Yard and to operate the trains and to operate all of the steam machinery that the Japanese still had.
In the Japanese shipyards.
Yeah, right. And I was the next in line to go.
I see.
But my friends went.
And they were armed? I mean, they would be issued rifles?
No. I think some of them had sidearms.
I see.
I don't know.
I just had heard that. That rumor. When did you leave the Navy?
I left the Navy on March 29th, 1946.
You remember that date?
3 years, 1 week, and I forget how many hours, but uh-huh. I remember. There's a little town in Nebraska that will always stand out in my mind and in every service man's mind that crossed the United States on a troop train. A town is North Platte, Nebraska. Those farmers had a spread of food for every troop train that went through. They had music, they had anything you wanted. Those farmers in North Platte supplied it. And I went there, I stopped there 3 times. I went across the United States 3 times on a train. And several times I've written letters. Those people are no longer alive, but to the town and the town council, expressing my gratitude for what they did for us. My son traveled out, and I think he's on Route 80, but I'm not sure. That in North Platte, there's a rest stop, and the people are still doing this for the travelers. Not a big spread like they did for us, but coffee and juice.
That's cookies. Quite a memory. Yeah. I think what...
I'm taking too much.
No. This is good. Our colleague here points out that it was not just the farmers, but the women too who made the pies.
Yeah, more the women than the farmers. Yeah. The farmers,
the good people of
the farmers probably supplied the stuff, and the women did all the preparation. But there's a great book. I don't know whether you've read it or not. Why can't I ever remember the name of that book?
We'll look it up.
I have it on my porch. I read that every once in a while.
I'm going to take a break now, get a drink of water, and maybe turn to the home front.
Yeah.
And this just resumes now from where it was. Claire, I'd like to ask you a little bit about the home front and what you were doing during World War II. First, what was your relationship to Henry during the war?
Well, Henry and I had a few dates in high school, and one when he was in Cheshire, and most of our dates were through mail, writing. And then when he'd get into port in Boston, he'd come down to New York, and I would take a bus, a train, and go to New York, and I would meet him, and then I'd come home, and he'd go home. And that was how most of our dates were.
This was during the war itself.
During the war.
Yeah.
And before the war, we didn't have too many dates because he went right from high school off to Connecticut.
Did you write a lot back and forth? Were you able
to
do that?
Not before the war.
Well, I mean during the war.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Lots. Yeah. Unfortunately, lost all those letters except for a few. But that was our courtship, really, was through letters. And then when he was in Japan, he had asked me to marry him when he was on his last leave. And I said yes, and my engagement ring came through the mail.
From Japan?
No, he had picked it out when he was home, and His mother had it, and she mailed it to me.
Uh-huh.
So I became engaged via the mail.
Yeah, a wartime romance.
Yes. Yeah. More or less.
As I understand it, you worked in defense or wartime industry during the war.
Right in high school, I have to preface this. At that period of time in the 1940s, 39s, you either had a commercial course or a college prep course.
Yeah.
Being one of five children, I knew I wasn't going to college, so I took the commercial course, and I got a job, clerical job after, and then moved to our present home, and I had a job in Morristown as a clerk, and my father started to work at Western Electric in Clifton, New Jersey, and it was everything was geared toward products for the war. Radios, I don't know what else. And so he told me, you know, you could earn a whole lot more money by working there. And I didn't like my job, and so I started working in Western Electric, Clifton, New Jersey. And it was a big, old, I think at one time, a silk mill or something. And there was a woman in Rockaway who also worked there. So the three of us would ride together.
You were living then in
Denville. I was living in Denville, yes. Three of us would ride together, and we worked six nights a week. We had very high pay. My pay, by the time I was done, was about $33.
A week.
And that was considered, that was considered very good money at that time. And I stayed there for, I can't say I liked the work. I did not like the work.
What kind of work did you actually do?
It was assembly work, but I was termed a relay adjuster. And a relay is a small, maybe 3-inch piece of equipment, and it had three blades, and the blades had to be properly spaced. And my job was to space them properly all day.
And that's it.
And I did not like that job. Yeah. To break up the monotony, they did have a radio, and we'd talk to each other, or somebody'd read a book, and you'd tell the story. Well, then we learned that we could transfer to aircraft radio in Boonton, New Jersey, which was very close to our homes. And Nellie, the one who drove, Nellie and I came to aircraft radio to work. My father stayed down in Western Electric. And same thing, I was a specialist, I was a relay adjuster, and they made radios for aircraft. And at that time, I was very bored with the work, and so I enrolled in a Red Cross nurse's aide course. And I used to work there 2 weeks days, 2 weeks nights, and they let me go all on the night shift for 3 months.
At aircraft radio,
so I could take a nurse's aide course. And I did that. I finished it. And Dover Hospital was about 6 miles away, I guess. And I would starch my uniform and ride my bicycle to town and take the bus to Dover. And interesting facts, at that time, if a woman had a baby, she stayed in the hospital in bed for 2 weeks. She did not even get to go out to use the bathroom or anything. And so it meant that people like the nurses' aides were given this kind of work. They were very shorter nurses, and they would do the bedpans and the bathing the patients, anything that didn't require. You could not give shots or do anything like that. And so I'd go there in the mornings about three times a week, and then I'd work at aircraft at night.
The nurse's aide, was this paid or volunteer work?
No, this was volunteer. And I worked at aircraft and happened to be on vacation with my sister, and we took a bus to Atlantic City. While we were in Atlantic City, VJ Day came. The war was over. And the hotels and all the places along the boardwalk were used for recuperating servicemen. And there were toilet paper streamers. It was a wild, wild night. If you walked on the boardwalk, the guys would grab you. So my sister and I went to the movies. We were scared stiff. And then we came home, and that was the end of my working at Aircraft.
Right away?
Right away. You never went back. They just kept their core crew there, core group.
But, I mean, it was that sudden. One day you were working, the next day you weren't.
The next day you weren't.
Yeah.
And so then...
How did that make you feel? Did you feel...
Well, I sure didn't like the job.
Yeah.
And I did. I was happy. I was very, very happy. I thought, oh, Henry's going to come home. We'll get married. And so I was in a hurry to get to that. And I got a job in the drugstore in Denville. And as far as the war goes, I remember the day that Henry came home. His ship landed in California. And he came across country. I guess he stopped at his parents' home first. And I was watching all day for him to come into the drugstore. And he came in. We closed at 9. He came in about 10 of 9. And I was in the back, and I was wiping glasses to put away. And he stopped, and he helped me dry the glasses and put them away. And the man who owned the drugstore came over and he said, "You didn't do that right. It's smeary," to him. And that was his homecoming.
I understand that you had a chance to go back and work at Aircraft at a pretty good wage.
After we were married, Henry went to college on the GI Bill. And I continued my work in the drugstore. And at the drugstore, I worked 6 days a week and had to take my turns a couple of evenings. And I got a call asking if I would come back to Aircraft Radio. And I would only have had to work 5 hours, 8 hours a day, $10 more a week. And so I thought, well, I better do this. I went back. And I sat down at the bench, and I thought, I can't do this. And I went up to the foreman, and I said, "I'm sorry, but I said, I hated this during the war, and I just cannot do it." And he asked me to stay 2 weeks, which I did. And then I went back to the drugstore, and I asked for my job back. And I got it.
Because as you know, a lot of women wanted to continue working at the wages they were getting, but weren't able to because returning servicemen or because
women
just weren't supposed to work in factories.
Well, they didn't have the need for it either. They weren't mass producing things for the planes. And at that time during the war, working 6 days, and we had gas rationing, we had people used to do all kinds of things to help and be a part of it. There were victory gardens, there were people would save the fat from meats and bring it into the butcher, and everybody was involved and felt this war. Whereas that's the difference today. It seems that's just these people who are serving over and all over the world that are involved, not we at home. It doesn't seem that we have to make any sacrifices. And you asked me once, how did it feel to have your two brothers and your husband, your boyfriend at the time, in service and in danger? And being young, I knew nothing was going to happen to them. They were just going to come home, I knew. I mean, I never was that fearful of it. I knew when D-Day happened, and we knew it before, when it was happening. It was
on
the radio.
Did you know that Henry was involved?
Yes, yeah.
You knew
yeah.
That
I don't
his
know
ship...
how I knew his... Well, you know, almost all the ships
of course,
were there,
yeah.
But I knew that he was there, and I went up in our backwoods, and I just sat for a long time. And during our supper breaks, we'd go down to the parking lot when he was in the Pacific, and you would hear that the ships were bombarding Okinawa or wherever they were. And the one man said to me, "Where's your boyfriend on the ship?" And I said, "He's in the engine room." "Oh, that's a worse place to be. If anything happens, he's going to be sealed in there." Well, I never knew that, but I knew it then. But it was just a thing that the whole country was involved. It's just a different feeling than now.
So you, some people talk about following the war, having a map and putting the pins in to show.
No,
you didn't follow it in that way,
no.
But you certainly knew what was going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we knew.
Yeah. I guess the question I wanted to ask was, what impact the war had on your decision to get married and start a family? I mean, you were engaged during the war. I mean, was there any sense of, how did that happen in connection with the war?
That's a question my granddaughter asked me.
Is that right? Yeah.
I said, Grandma, how did you know you wanted to get married? And I said, I don't know. We just had decided when he came home, we'd get married. Didn't have any money. But we were very, very fortunate. I knew there was an empty house and very near to where I would work, or he would have to work, in Denville. And I went to the lady. It was a small house on a very small estate. And I went to the lady and I said, I knew that the house was empty. Would there be a possibility of renting it to us? And she said, I said, my fiance is going to be coming home and we're going to be married. And she said, well, bring your fiance here when my husband is here. And so we both went down and talked to him. And the man said, yes, you may have the house for $1 a month, I think it was.
$1 a month.
And he said, but in the winter, I'd like you to clear the driveway and shovel. And he also said, I'd like you to paint the rooms. And he said, you go down to the hardware store, and as long as it's not outlandish, pick out whatever colors you want and paint the rooms. And yes, you may live there. Until June, and that was the end of August, until June we lived there. Then they wanted that house. And so we went off on our honeymoon, got married, went on our honeymoon. And when we came back, there was a ton of coal in the cellar. There was food in the refrigerator, and icebox, not refrigerator. And the people were so very good to us. And I think it was their way of helping this returning serviceman get a start back here.
Because I remember Henry was mustered out on the 29th of March, 1946, and I know you were married on August 25th mm-hmm. of that same year, so you guys didn't wait very long.
No, but his family was living in West Virginia, and I often think that must have been hard for them because he came back to see them, and then he came east and stayed with your grandmother in Ridgefield. Is that right? Yeah. And you know, we saw each other, and we got married, and
The rest is history.
The rest is history. We're still married.
Did you have something to ask? Okay.
So yeah. I don't know what more I can.
Well, no, that's great. It's important to get some of the perspectives of people who were very much a part of this whole thing. Yeah. I didn't know about the nurse's aide part.
You didn't know about that? No. I'd have my starched uniform and go off on my bicycle and 3 mornings a week and then work at aircraft at night. And it was good. And when I grew up, and it was depression times, I never remember my mother or father saying to me, what would you like to do when you graduate? Never, ever. I mean, just never came up.
Yeah.
And I didn't like office work, but that's what I knew I could do. And then when I went to become a nurse's aide, a volunteer nurse's aide, my mother said to me, why didn't you tell us you would like to have been a nurse? We would have been able to do something so you could do that.
They didn't.
But it was never discussed, you know.
Yeah.
And at that time, and without any resentment, just about all my money I gave to the family because it was a struggling time.
Even during the war?
Even during the war.
And were you also saving up for
Well, I saved
married?
War bonds. And that was the extent of my savings. But and even when I went to the drugstore to work, I didn't give as much because we were going to get married and I didn't make that much.
Sure, yeah.
But it was
But later on in your life, after your kids had grown up, you did make opportunities for yourself to work with children.
And, yes, came about by, you're not recording this.
Yeah.
Oh. It came about because when our son was in third grade, the youngest, second or third grade, I wanted to do something. And we had a friend who said we're very badly in need of substitute teachers. Why don't you take a course?
This would be in the 1950s, basically.
I guess. Yeah. And so I did. I took a high school adult ed course in substitute teaching. And a friend who was in a very small school system in Mine Hill, New Jersey, said, put your name in. We need them so badly. They only had two schools, maybe one at that time. And so I did. But I didn't feel qualified to go into a classroom. So I went to see the superintendent and I said, would it be possible for me to observe, go to a classroom and observe for a period of months, just to get a feel of this? And he said, yes, and I did. I learned a lot. And that came about because our older son was in fifth grade, and he would come home, his teacher became ill, and he'd come home so frustrated and angry and said, we sat in the chair and copied words from books and on the blackboard all day, and that's how I started getting into a substitute teaching, which led to being a substitute in a nursery school one day a week because the teacher was going to adopt a baby. And I was asked to take the class the rest of the year from April through June, which I did. And then the lady asked me to come back the following fall and asked if I would take courses. And I said, yes, I would. And she paid for my courses. And that's how I got started in preschool.
And then you had a preschool, you would hold preschool here at your
home
after a while.
I had worked at a school in Mountain Lakes, Hartman School, for how many years? 15 or 20 years. Mm-hmm. Mrs. Hartman was moving and closing the school. My father had had a stroke, and I thought I'd be taking care of him, so I left Hartman School and could not take care of Pop. So I started my own little school in our home, and I called it a playgroup because I was not licensed, and I kept, if I had five children or six, I did not have to be licensed at that time. Now you do. And I had a regular curriculum here, art and music and environmental ed, everything. So wonderful years.
So you made your own way in doing some of the things that you wanted to
and
do.
And I loved it. Yeah. It was something I loved. Mm-hmm. I felt so fortunate to do that. And I went to Morris County College, and I took an aptitude test. And at that time, they'd send you a printout. Well, the printout went from this part of the living room all the way across. And what it boiled down to was that I would be a good teacher, a good principal, a playground supervisor, and something with gardening. And I thought, well, I am a principal. I am a superintendent. I am a teacher. I guess I'm doing what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah. Well,
so that great. Was my wonderful years of doing that. I loved it.
Let me turn to Henry's post-war years and experience here, too, because we need to do it from this point of view as well. A lot of vets had a hard time making this transition from wartime and what they had seen in the war to peacetime. Doesn't seem like you had that difficult a transition. You knew what you wanted to do, and you went out and did it. But maybe I'm wrong.
You're right. But things are different now with service people coming home. They can be in a war zone and be in the United States within a couple of hours.
Yeah.
And I can see where that would be a tremendous adjustment. When I came back to this country from Japan, it took us about 12 days to get across the ocean. And then they didn't discharge you right away. We sat in under the Golden Gate Bridge in California. I was there for maybe a month or so.
Just on board ship.
Yeah, but I could go ashore and, you know, do things. But there was the adjustment there was not as nearly as abrupt as it is now. And when I came home, it was...
And then you had to go all the way across the country on a trip. That must have taken a couple of days. I did that once.
Longer. Yeah. The first time across was in a converted boxcar. Uh-huh. You probably don't remember those there before your time, when they took old freight cars and put a couple of windows in them and the way you went.
Yeah. Yeah. So, was this, you and Claire were engaged during the war. Was this always your plan? When I get back soon after, we'll get married and begin our life together?
I don't think it was.
No.
Huh? No, I didn't plan per se. I didn't think tomorrow we're going to get married. I knew eventually I thought that would happen, but I didn't think quickly. But I could have missed the point. I wrote a letter to Pop.
To her father and my father, of course, too.
And I told him my intentions. And I said, I don't have a job. I don't have anything. I had the money I saved because there wasn't any place to spend it on the ship. I had about $600, and you can have her.
That's a lot of money for the Zeger family.
I thought you talked to him.
Why did you decide to attend a teacher's college? You went to Newark State College, New Jersey State College at Newark, and the teacher's college. Why did you decide to go there and to pursue a career as a teacher?
A couple of things. One, I was always interested in young people. I was always very active in Boy Scouts. I liked working with kids. I liked working with tools. I think both of them kind of fit together. That I could, you could be an industrial arts teacher and do have both the best worlds. And I decided that's what I was going to do. And I went back to my high school. And the first thing that the old advisor told me, and this was after 5 or 6 years, you'll never make it. I'm not giving you a recommendation.
Yeah.
So that's the way it was. So I didn't want to give up. So I went back to the man who was a teacher at high school when Claire and I went there, and was the superintendent of schools in Richfield, where I grew up. And I said, Mr. Albom, I'd like to go to college to be an industrial arts teacher. He said, why not? And he picked up the telephone. And he said, oh, wait a minute, before I make this call, where would you like to go? He said, well, I've been thinking about Trenton State College. So he called Trenton, and Trenton had no openings. So he called Newark, but then it was Newark State Teachers College. And he said, well, we have a couple of openings, we'll be glad to have them. So that's how I got involved with Newark State College.
So this was these interviews with your former principal. This was after you had gotten out of the service?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right. You got out of the service. Worked, I think you worked at the A&P for a while. Was that then? Or?
I worked at a...
Well, I mean, right away you took some jobs. And when did you begin at college?
I began college in 1946.
Yeah. So right away, fall of 46.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Did you, were you able to take advantage of the GI Bill?
I took advantage of the GI Bill. And I had about a month on the 5220 Club.
That's the unemployment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I had about a month where I had unemployment.
And for the 5220 is you were entitled, in theory at least, to $20.
Yeah, for a year.
A week for 52 weeks. Yeah.
But then I went on a GI Bill, and when I look back at that, I'm very fortunate. I was lucky to be able to do all the things. But I'll have to look back and say, why didn't you pick an expensive school? Because the tuition at New York State was $25 a semester.
We could have gone to
Could have gone any place.
So this is sort of an open-ended sort of question, and just what about your World War experience in the rest of your life, that as a husband, as a father, as a citizen, as a teacher, how does that fit into to your life?
I think I said before, I didn't like what I had to do, but it was one of the best experiences that I could have ever had. There's no question I changed from a boy to a man in those 3 years. No question that I had formed attitudes about people, those who went out of their way to help you, and those who always had remarks that would put you down. And when I became a teacher, I said, no way am I going to put any person down. No way. And my 37 years, I never put a person down. I don't care how bad the student is. I don't care about any of that. You can always find something good to say about somebody.
And this would be in part because you got that kind of encouragement from your shipmates your superior officers?
Yeah. I think from that and from my experiences before I went in and after I came out, how I was treated, had a big effect on it. I don't think in our whole married life, I ever yelled or got impatient or mistreated anyone in my family. And that includes the extended family. I have always felt this is the most important thing in my life, my family. If you can't help them, if you can't support them, forget it.
These are not the lessons that everyone gets out of military experience. Sometimes come out very hard and very aggressive and so on.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's, for observation from the interviewer, it's not just the experience, it's the character of the person we're talking about here,
probably,
too.
Probably a lot. I mean, I grew up in a peace.
Sure. And supportive family.
Yeah.
But
life is good.
In 2008, you were honored by the French government as a Chevalier of the Legion of Honor.
That's true.
Was quite an honor.
A very special honor.
Yeah. For your participation in the Normandy.
Not because I was a hero, but as I told you before, the 117th. Yeah.
That division you were talking about, yeah.
Yeah, was split. And because our ship supported both halves of this unit, I was chosen not because I'm special, because I was there.
because you participated in both parts of the, the campaign.
And this came about because my wife and I are both on the program committee of a senior citizen group in a neighboring town. And I became very friendly with another sailor, former sailor. And we used to prepare service holidays, like Memorial Day and Veterans Day. It would be our job to get a speaker. And we were looking for a speaker for Memorial Day, and my friend said to me, "Do you mind if I get a speaker?" I said, "No." And he was able to get a citizen from Mountain Lakes to come in, who was a major in the French Air Force. And he brought a wonderful program about D-Day and France. And when he was finished, he asked if anybody had been at D-Day. And four or five of us stood up, and he said, "Thank you." He said, "The French people will never forget this." And we sat down, and he said, "How many of you were at Southern France?" And I was the only one that stood up. And this is how this whole thing came about. Because I was lucky enough to be in the right place at the right time twice.
Yeah, that's quite a story.
Yeah, and I, to go along with that, one day my son called from Iowa, and I don't know just how this happened, and when he comes I have to ask him. I was working in my basement, and the phone rang, and Claire answered, and she said, "You know, Richard's on the phone, he wants to talk to you." So I got on the phone, and Rich said, "Dad, sit down." I said, "I can't sit down, I'm working in the cellar." He said, "Sit down." I said, "What's up?" And he said, "I just had a call from the French embassy, and they want to pay you and Mom's way to Normandy Beach, and I forget what anniversary that was. And you will be with President Obama and President
Sarkozy.
On the beach at Normandy together." And holy mackerel, how come? And he said, "Well, I don't know why they called me, but didn't you know about this?" I said, "No, I didn't know about it." So then I called the French embassy and had that cleared up. And what I found out, it was to go to France and back. And it would be 3 or 4 days. It was just out of the question. Too old to do that. So that's how that came about.
But you did attend and were honored at a ceremony at the French legation.
And that was, to me, that was better. Because both of our sons could be there. My one grandson could make it. My one daughter-in-law could make it. So it was very nice.
Quite a tribute. Yeah. Have you had a chance over the years to talk about your experiences with young people?
Oh, yes. Quite a number of times. I go every year to school in town. And they have, for Veterans Day, which is coming up shortly, school is open, but it's closed. And the kids don't go to class, really. They invite a veteran to come in, and the kids put on a nice program. The PTA puts on a lunch. And then they ask you to go into each one of the classrooms and answer kids' questions and talk to them about your experience. Very wonderful thing has happened. I've been to a number of high schools and talked to people. Some of the high schools have projects, and they have their kids contact a veteran and go to make an appointment and go to their house and they talk to them. And just this year, I had a call from my son's wife's sister's nephew in New Hampshire. Could he interview me over the telephone? And I said, well, this is really nice. And really, when I look at what's happening to veterans now, it's what should have happened a long time ago. Nobody ever opened their mouth and said anything. And now they're pursuing the veterans, and the veterans are beginning to talk more and more and tell more stories. And I think that's good.
Well, I want to thank you for your participation in this program. This is a great interview, and thank both of you very much.
You're welcome.
You know, there's a couple of things that you didn't ask that would...
Well, I did have a final thing which I didn't say. What are there further thoughts that ought to be?
Yeah. I'm intrigued by the way questions are answered.
Answered.
Asked and answered.
Okay.
In my day, all of the communication between you and your family or your friends was handwritten letters. You wrote the letters and they were censored. If you put down the spaghetti was too sharp, the censor would cut it out.
This is during the war.
During the war, yeah. He would cut that out. If you said, I'm in Egypt, that would be cut out. Some of the letters that arrived home, and I don't know whether yours ever did, because I was very careful what I wrote, but a lot of people, it was like this tablecloth all full of holes. And nowadays, these kids that are in Iraq and all over, a cell phone in their home, which in my day never happened. When you would be at sea, and that's a question a lot of the kids would ask, how long were you at sea without seeing land? And we were out one stretch about 40 days. And what you have to do is you looking out over the ocean, you see a speck out there, and all of a sudden that speck's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's a supply ship, and it pulls alongside. They put hoses across so they can pump fuel, so they can pump other things over, and they give you your mail. And the first thing you do when you get your mail is look at the postmarks and sort them all out so that you put them in numerical order. That way, you read the first letter first and the last letter last, and you can have a little coordination in what you're getting. I think. True, that when you're out that long at sea, what do you do to keep from going stir crazy? And on the new ship, there were very few breakdowns that I would have to go down to the engine room and do repair. And one of the favorite things that we would do in Japan is we'd go up and sit, and they would purposely tune in Tokyo Rose, and we'd sit and listen to Tokyo Rose talk, and then first thing you know, hey, you guys on the Quincy, why don't you go home? Your girlfriends are going out with all the guys at home, and you're here. And you get a big laugh out of all of this stuff. You know, that's one way time was passed. Time was passed through cards. There's a lot of cards going. I wasn't a gambler, but I liked to play Pinochle, and we'd three or four of us would play cards. Gambling is a big thing on a ship. And one day, there must have been $1,000 with a bunch of guys gambling on the deck. And it's against the rules to gamble. And the master at arms came through, and he picked $1,000 up, and he walked away. Needless to say, he didn't make the next port. He was gone. And that happens once in a while. Like from what I hear from other ships, that happened once, not ours. They have movies.
Well, wait, back to the sergeant at arms. You mean someone pushed him overboard?
Well, I can't say for sure, but he disappeared.
But that was at least the speculation.
Yeah. Can't say for sure.
Well, I just wanted to clarify that disciplinary action wasn't taken against him.
Yeah, it was.
Something happened
to him.
We
had movies. And you could go down to, a lot of times, if we weren't in a real dangerous area, they'd be on a deck. Or we'd go in a hangar deck where it would be all blocked out and you could watch a movie. When President Roosevelt came on, that was one of his favorite things. He would request movies, and we'd all be able to watch them. We would pull into islands, island of Mog Mog. Nobody ever heard of Mog Mog. The island of Eniwetok, which is no more. We blew it out of the ocean.
Yeah, the atomic test.
We'd pull in there. They'd give you 3 cans of warm beer and let you go over for an hour or so with a baseball bat and some balls, and you could play ball, you could go swimming. And the swimming was never very good because there's so much coral that if you did go swimming and a wave hit you, you'd be all cut up. But that was the big thing when you go off with your 3 cans of beer. And me not being a drinker, everybody was my friend. But these things, I remember President Roosevelt was very interested in boxing. And that's a big thing in the Navy. One ship will fight another ship and you get a fleet champion out of it. And, we'd always have boxing matches when he was on. He was a chain smoker, and a friend of mine was an elevator operator for him. And he would never smoke on the deck. He felt that was not right. He smoked, and the sailors couldn't smoke. So he'd tell the elevator operator, stop between decks. And he would smoke between the decks. So, yeah, that's what I can tell you. I could go on for a long time with stories, but no.
Well, let me thank you for doing this and participating in the program, both of you, and thanks very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.